what they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. This week, I speak with two guests. First, an interview with Vijay Prashad, the director of Tricontinental, the Institute for Social Research. And then an interview with Paul Dobson, a journalist with Venezuela Analysis who lives in Venezuela. I'm currently in Caracas, Venezuela, where I've been for the past few days to serve as an official election observer of the Venezuelan parliamentary election that took place on Sunday, December 6th. And yes, there are official election observers in Venezuela from the United States, despite what you will hear in the corporate media. There are, in fact, I understand, 4,500 observers from around the world in Venezuela here to watch the election. Our contingent is considered official because we were invited by the National Electoral Council, which is an independent government body that oversees the elections. Venezuela has at least one election every year. It's a deeply democratic country, although you won't hear that either in the corporate media. The other election observers are people who were brought in by social movements or political parties. And a lot of the reason that I wanted to be an official election observer and others in the group that came down from the United States is because there is so much misinformation in the United States corporate media and even some of the so-called independent media that don't give you the real story of what's happening down here. You are likely hearing in the corporate media that this election was fraudulent or rigged. And in fact, the United States has been saying that for a long time about Venezuelan elections. And they start saying it even before the election happens. They start saying that the election is going to be illegitimate even before it happens. And that's because the United States has been trying to overthrow the elected government of Venezuela, this government that's been part of this Bolivarian process that's been going on for the past couple of decades, has been one that has stood up to the United States domination and refused to give in, despite, as you'll hear from Vijay Prashad, the hybrid war that is being waged against Venezuela. And so one of the ways that the U.S. can do that is by claiming that Venezuela is not a democracy, that it doesn't have reliable elections. So I came down to witness the process, and through the National Electoral Council, they showed us how the machines work, how they do their safety protocols and quality assurance protocols to make sure the machines are working. They showed us the steps that the voters go through during the election so that when we were out there on election day looking at what was going on, we could talk to voters, we could talk to the election officials, we could talk to the observers, because political parties and really anybody is allowed to come in and observe, you know, what's going on with the election. It's a very open and transparent process. And I have to say, it was impressive that in the middle of a pandemic, Venezuela was able to hold this election. And they use very strong public health measures to protect voters from, you know, spreading or catching COVID-19. So we went around to a number of different voting centers, and as I said, we spoke to the voters and to the staff there and the watchers. And basically, Venezuela uses both a, you know, computerized voting machine as well as a paper receipt that the voters get. So voters would first come in, they had voters waiting in line with tape on the floor, so they were spaced out appropriately, and then only one voter was brought into the room where the voting apparatus was. It's usually like a classroom. A lot of this took place in schools. And they had a setup so that the voter would come in and go to one table where they would show their ID. The staff would not actually touch the ID. They would just look at it. And then the staff would put in their ID number. The voter would put their finger onto a, you know, digital fingerprint screen, and that would verify that they are in fact the person with that ID. That would activate the machine. After they put their finger on the machine and the person's hand, it gets sprayed with alcohol disinfectant. Then they go to the machine. It's a very simple process. They were just
placing two votes, really, for their delegate and also for a political party that they support, because Venezuela uses both a direct election of delegates to the National Assembly as well as a proportional representation system. Once they submit their vote on the machine, it puts out a paper receipt that they can then look at and verify that their vote was recorded the way that they intended. They then fold that paper in half and put it inside a box associated with that machine. Then they step around to the checkout table where they again show their ID. The poll worker finds their name on the sheet of paper. The person signs their name next to where their printed name is and then puts another fingerprint there, this time an ink fingerprint, and that verifies that they, you know, completed the voting process. Then at the end of the day, what's interesting, and this is really different from the United States, in every polling center, they audit 54% of the machines that are there, but they count the paper receipts and make sure that they match up with what's reading, you know, reading comes out of the computerized voting machine. And for this audit, it's done completely publicly by hand. So it's a very reliable system, not a fraudulent system. It's not a rigged system. And when we spoke to Venezuelan voters, they expressed high confidence in their voting system and that they felt that it was, you know, reliable and secure. So this is really different from what you're going to hear in the United States. And just want to talk a little bit about the current political environment down here, because it was in January of 2019 that the United States again attempted a coup against the elected government. They claimed that President Maduro was not elected. In fact, he was elected. Kevin Zeis, who was the co-host of this show, was there for that election and has talked about that many times and how well-run that election was. But the U.S. ignored that and supported this person who wasn't deputy of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido. He came from a very small state, and just recognized him as the president and then started handing over Venezuelan assets to this person. And this person, Juan Guaido, of course, supported the U.S. imposing economic war on Venezuela as well as threatening military intervention, completely out of step where the majority of Venezuelan people are from left to right. And we talked to political candidates who represent the actual opposition parties in Venezuela who said that they don't support U.S. intervention. They don't support the economic sanctions. They want them to end. They want to restore diplomatic relations with the United States. And they actually said to us, the election observers, that this Juan Guaido and his kind of political grouping, this far-right political grouping, would only exist because of the United States. They don't have a base of support within the country itself. Their base of support comes from the U.S. propping them up to use them for their interests. And they wanted the people in the United States to know that there actually is an opposition party to the party that's in power, the right party, and actually multiple parties. And they want their voices to be heard in the United States, not this fake far-right opposition that's propped up by the United States. They too are concerned about, you know, the current economic crisis in Venezuela, largely due to the United States economic blockade. But they believe in the institutions of Venezuela. They believe that the electoral system is secure, and they wanted to, you know, try to be elected into the National Assembly so that they could actually work through a democratic institution to put their ideas forward and, you know, try to make changes to what things are going on inside the country right now. And I think it's really important when you listen to the second interview with Paul Dobson, he will talk about some corruption going on within Venezuela. And I think as people in the United States, it's really important for us to understand that that's a criticism that's coming from somebody within the country. And they have the right to make that criticism of their government. But we in the United States have to be careful because it's not our place to judge the elected government of another country that was chosen by the people who live inside that country. And so too often the U.S. will use any criticism of a government to justify and say, see, look, I told you, this is not a good government. This is corrupt. I don't think there's any government in the world that doesn't have some level of corruption, and Venezuela is no exception to that. But it should not be used to justify U.S. intervention or U.S. aggression or for people in the United States to basically go against the wishes of the people of that country. And it's a lesson that we too often don't understand in the United States. So we do have to be careful that we don't adopt that pro-imperialist attitude that has been so destructive towards Venezuela and many other countries. I also think it's important for people in the United States to understand, and Vijay Prashad talks about this as well, that when the Bolivarian Revolution took place at the beginning of this century, this came in on the heels of decades of governments that basically turned the country's resources over to private investors and transnational corporations. So there were a lot of people who got very wealthy off the resources of Venezuela, while the majority of the population lived in extreme poverty, and some were not even on the map, didn't have access to running water or electricity or public transportation. And when the Bolivarian process began to change that, it didn't come in and wipe the country clean. Those business people, some people in government, people who didn't support the political process that was going on, the Bolivarian process, still exist. And so when, you know, people talk about their corruption existing within Venezuela, oftentimes it's these private interests that continue to do what we see in many governments of trying to get away with policies and practices that benefit their interests and not the people. So again, I just want to reiterate these interviews with Vijay Prashad and Paul Dobson are really important so people in the United States can understand the context of what's going on in Venezuela. But we should understand that Paul, who criticizes the current government, is doing that from an insider perspective, and that's okay for him to do, but I caution people not to do that as well. So why don't we get right to these interviews, and we'll start out with Vijay Prashad.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog. I'm Margaret Flowers.
And now I turn to my first guest, Vijay Prashad. He is the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. Thank you so much for joining me, Vijay.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yes.
So we're talking from Caracas, Venezuela. They just had their National Assembly election yesterday. You have a new book that's come out on hybrid warfare. Can you first start out by talking to the listeners about what hybrid warfare is?
Yeah, so, you know, everybody knows what warfare is, and we understand that as being a full-scale attack on a country, military attack with, you know, bombing from the air after bombing from the air became possible, and then invasions with troops and so on. But from very early on, it was understood that war is not just the physical act of a military attacking another place, but also there were other aspects of warfare, demoralizing the civilian population of your adversary and so on. In other words, information war. There were diplomatic wars, isolating a country, you know, this is right down there in the Peloponnesian Wars. Herodotus and others, Thucydides writes about how, you know, you have to isolate an enemy diplomatically. So this stuff has been going on for years, information war, diplomatic war, financial war, economic war, and so on. Since the last maybe 10 years or 15 years, the United States government, I think, has come to an understanding that it can obliterate a country, for instance, Iraq. It can obliterate the country's military. It can obliterate its main infrastructure. It can't win the war. In other words, it can't subordinate the population. So another strategy has been developed. They call it sometimes full-spectrum war, fourth-generation warfare, etc., where they've attempted to use other means than a full-scale military attack to demoralize the public, to finance elements inside the adversarial country who'll support U.S. goals and so on. And so that we call a hybrid war. And with Venezuela, for instance, it's been pretty straightforward since the election result. In fact, no, since the first election campaign of Hugo Chavez in 1998, when the United States, Canada and other powers like that made it very clear, we're not interested in legitimizing this government, however much it has popular support, whether it wins the election, whether they win 20-some elections in the last 20 years, whether they're able to write a new constitution that everybody accepts. None of that is important. What we'll do is delegitimize the government. Information war, we'll call their elected leaders a tyrant or authoritarian. Diplomatic war, we'll squeeze them through the Organization of American States, which effectively, if we're honest, is a branch of the U.S. State Department. You know, we'll put on them economic war. We won't allow them to trade, normal trade relations with anybody outside the country. We'll place secondary, very illegal sanctions where we penalize businesses that are actually not directly doing business in the United States, but indirectly. They'll also get struck down. So there's economic war, commercial war, financial war. We won't let the country use financial institutions. And so what they've done is they've been able to create a hyper hyperinflation situation in Venezuela, which is really the primary issue. Venezuela cannot properly trade its oil, can't therefore collect dollars, has a major currency problem, which has lasted for years. South American countries, on average, have a hyperinflation or even overheated inflation for about 4 months before they recover. Venezuela just hasn't been able to recover, partly because of the dollarized world trade system. Cannot access dollars as a hard time, and this has put an enormous pressure on the public, on the government, and is therefore really screwed up the political sovereignty of the country.
And do you think in part that for people in the United States who are opposed, I think the majority of the people in the United States are opposed to outright bombing people in other countries, do you think that this type of warfare serves another purpose in making it a little bit more palatable for people in the U.S.?
Well, sure. It's this form, this hybrid warfare legitimizes a form of really strangulation of a country because it appears as if you're doing nothing. I mean, you know, Obama, when he tightened the sanctions against Venezuela, came out there with an entire human rights sort of agenda. You know, it's humanitarian interventionism, but apparently light on intervention, although it's pretty heavy on intervention because the impact of the hybrid war bleeds the country slowly. You don't kill by shooting, you bleed the country slowly. So it, in fact, in my opinion, is much more devastating, this form of warfare, than direct bombardment. And people abroad seem indifferent because on television, you don't see the visuals of, you know, U.S. planes bombing downtown Caracas. You don't have visuals, you don't see the body bags, you know, of anybody being cut. What you see is you see the country where young people have a harder time getting jobs, where even Chavistas, those who support the regime, will show you that their pants have been loosened because they're losing weight as a population. I mean, this is a scandalous form of warfare, which most UN special rapporteurs have condemned. The UN General Assembly has many times said that this is just outrageous. And, you know, my old friend Idris Jezire, who died this year, was a UN special rapporteur for basically coercive sanctions. I mean, he gave a statement in January 2019 where, this is how he put it, "I'm told that they are trying to use sanctions to bring down the government of Venezuela." He said, "This is illegal and inappropriate and shouldn't be done." And this is Idris Jezire, who's one of the most respected international diplomats, began from Algeria, in the world. You know, he's held a number of important UN posts. People like Idris Jezire making a statement like that, completely unreported in the US media. The US media is basically, when it comes to foreign policy, has allowed itself to be a spokesperson for the State Department. And I think that's a problem. So I don't blame people in the United States for not knowing about things like the hybrid war and so on, or the impact on Venezuela. They'll just see, you know, something that says Nicolas Maduro equals dictator. And that just sort of stops the conversation. Well, Nicolas Maduro is not a dictator. Nicolas Maduro leads a political process. He himself was a bus driver, became a bus driver union leader, entered into the constitutional process initially as a constituent assembly member, served 2 terms in the National Assembly. Then he was drawn from the National Assembly in 2010 by Hugo Chavez to become the foreign minister. After Chavez fell ill, very badly ill with cancer, when oil prices began to drop, when the hybrid war was deepened, poor Nicolas Maduro suddenly had to fight against the collapse of oil prices, intensified sanctions from Obama and Trump, and on top of that, a pandemic. This is the situation that Nicolas Maduro has had to confront. And it's stunning that people outside are willing to just accept the Pompeo position that defines him in the way that he is defined. You know, it's comical how even people on the left, in the European and North American left, would so casually say, "I'm with Chavez, not with Maduro." Seriously? And let me just tell you, friends on the left out there who have this attitude, I'm certainly not with you.
Well, as if, you know, we're the ones that decide who's the legitimate president in a country or not, and not the people of that own country. And you talked about this being sold as humanitarian warfare and not the bomb dropping. But in fact, the Center for Economic Policy and Research found that in just 2017 to 2018, these economic, you know, measures have contributed to the deaths of 40,000 people. Now, you talked about the media kind of misinformation campaign, which has been very effective in the U.S. But another one is the use of non-governmental organizations to serve as propaganda and legitimize the U.S.'s position. Can you talk a little bit about that in Venezuela?
Yeah, so, you know, in the book I published recently, Washington Bullets, there's a section on the coup in Guyana where it wasn't a non-governmental organization as such, but the AFL-CIO that played a role, where the American labor movement, in many cases totally a proxy front for American regime change operations in Guyana, operated to help overthrow the government of Cherry Jagan. And a senior British diplomat said, in the course of the research of this book, I found it was an amazing statement. He said, it's not the AFL-CIO, it's the AFL-CIA. Because the AFL-CIO, for many, many instances, operated as a front for the CIA because they would buy up labor leaders, they would encourage them to go on strike, put pressure on legitimate governments in order for it to appear that it was a popular demonstration against the government. In Guyana, it's all in the public domain. You know, I didn't even have to do a FOIA request, Freedom of Information request, for any of the material on Guyana, because it's all in the public library of the CIA. Just to put that out there, you can go and look at it. In Venezuela, it's been the same. You know, there's been a direct attempt by the U.S. government to manufacture an opposition. There is an opposition in this country. There were two old parties, Acción Democrática and COPE, that have governed this country forever. And they are basically parties of the oligarchy. We met with some of them recently. They're basically, you know, white guys in suits who basically live in Altamira and in Mercedes. And their families have dominated the country since its founding. You know, well, not exactly since the founding, but since the coup against the Bolivarian early period. Well, so here they are. They are the opposition and have ruled the country for decades. They are in the country. They want a political process. They're not interested. Yeah, so, you know, when you think about this election, it's a National Assembly election. 32% is roughly the turnout. We'll get the full numbers later. These are people who came out in the middle of a pandemic. There's sanctions and blockade against this country. There's a lack of fuel, which means that buses to polling centers had been struck. I was actually quite concerned about the fact that there were fuel shortages in the middle of an election. And this has an impact for people. You know, there's demoralization because of the nature of the hybrid war against Venezuela. All of this has an impact on the polling. 32% came out to vote. The opposition won about 30-odd, one-third of the seats, which is not bad, you know, in a normal election campaign. They're running against incumbency. They're running against a government which has quite credibly taken care of people in the pandemic and so on. It's believable that they would have got 67%. But let's look at this. In Costa Rica last year, this very year, the beginning of the year, before the pandemic struck, Costa Rica had a legislative election. They had about 34% turnout before the pandemic. These are average numbers, 32% for a legislative body election. It's not the presidential election. That's important to know. Plus, a section of the extremist opposition did boycott the election, called for abstention, intimidated people. All of this makes an impact. This was a pretty good election. I mean, let's face it. You know, in the United States, there was a presidential election. Donald Trump has still refused to certify the election. This is a presidential election, so it's supposed to have a much more proper procedures and so on. By the end of the evening in Venezuela, nobody contested the polls. None of the opposition parties said that there was fraud, and they accepted the polls. But the European Union and the United States contested it. I read the European Union statement. It was probably drafted 3 weeks ago. Totally stale, no evidence. This is the planet they want to live in. It's actually quite sad that the public in Europe and the United States of America and in Canada, because Canada is an arch culprit in all this. Canada, it's a real tragedy. It's a shame, actually, that the public in these North Atlantic states don't know what their government is doing, or they don't seem to care.
You know, you talked about the impact of this hybrid warfare on Venezuela, and I think the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research has been involved in Venezuela for quite a while. At the beginning of the Bolivarian process and revolution, at the beginning of this century, there was a lot of hope, there was a lot of enthusiasm, and they have been very resistant through, you know, to U.S. imperialism this whole time. But how have you seen things changing here as a result of this long-term war against Venezuela?
Look, there's a problem for all socialist experiments that rely on commodity prices. Venezuela relied on its oil revenues. That's a big problem. It's a one-crop economy. Cuba, from 1959, relied on the sugarcane harvest. It's debilitating. You have these semi-colonial places like Venezuela, or directly colonized like Cuba, which became essentially one crop producers, and they couldn't diversify their economies fast enough. Cuba still struggles with the fact that its economy is not totally diversified. Venezuela never really was able to fully diversify its economy during the Bolivarian process. It still relies heavily on oil exports. This is a serious vulnerability for any Venezuelan government, not just the Bolivarian revolution. And I think it's got to be on the frontal area of everybody's mind. How how to get through reliance on oil revenues. Comunas are important. You democratize production. It's important to grow organic produce and so on. Democratize agriculture. All that is important and it's really good. But you've got to scale up production. I mean, we still see reliance on import of basic things like soft drinks, juices, biscuits. This stuff can be produced either inside Venezuela or produced regionally. That was the hope of Mercosur. That was the hope of ALBA. These things are legitimate and correct approaches forward. So in our institute, we've done a lot of studies of the importance of regionalism, the importance of diversifying the economy and moving away from, you know, just relying on oil exports, because this is something that the United States has used. They've taken advantage of the vulnerability of reliance on oil exports.
Some people who, you know, are interested in socialism but haven't actually done the work of building a socialist economy have been very critical of Venezuela. And even I think some people within Venezuela have been critical that it hasn't moved socialist fast enough. And there's been some concern of people on the left about the Maduro administration's recent moves, you know, towards allowing some privatization. What are your thoughts on that in the context of the bigger political picture?
Well, firstly, I'd just like to say that Twitter socialists don't interest me, because Twitter socialists have never actually tried to govern anything or win anywhere. They are professional criticizers. And, you know, they're entitled to their criticism, but I don't take them seriously, honestly, because I learn more from people who struggle with the dialectic of history. I learn much more from the government of Vietnam, which has struggled to build socialism out of a devastated situation. The United States destroyed Vietnam's agriculture by using Agent Orange, destroyed the entire central, very important agricultural zone. So you bomb a country to smithereens, you destroy it, and then you laugh at it and say, oh, it's sold out to capitalism, etc. Look, no country wants to socialize poverty. One of the great sadnesses of the 20th century was what Pol Pot did in Cambodia. That is inexcusable. That was genocidal. That is not the advance of socialism. We don't close a country down and socialize poverty. You have to advance the productive forces. You've got to build productivity of labor. You have to socialize labor. You can't do that without capital investment. You know, you just can't do that. People who just dismiss China, they dismiss Vietnam, they are just professional dismissals. Mrs. Margaret, I just can't take them seriously. I'm interested in studying how poor countries that are advancing towards socialism have to struggle to build capital, form capital in order to properly socialize labor, to advance the productive forces, to liberate people from necessity. That's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in some bullshit measurement that you have. You have some sort of, you know, ruler, like a ruler by which you go out, a litmus test, where you test a country to your abstract standard. That doesn't interest me. It may interest people who have a kind of academic interest in socialism. But people in the real world, this is not useful for them. They have to build socialism with what they have. You know, as Marx wrote, you don't create the world out of nothing. You inherit nightmares of the past and then you walk forward. What people inherited in Cuba was a nightmare. The Batista regime left behind a nightmare. The many several decades of COPE and Acción Democrática in Venezuela left behind a nightmare. It is up to the people of Venezuela, Cuba. It was up to Thomas Sankara and the Burkinabe revolution, which attempted to do something in Burkina Faso. They killed him. They destroyed that revolution. Why? Because they don't want us to experiment. We experiment. Our socialism doesn't come out of a textbook. It comes out with our basically experiments in the dialectic of history.
So finally, you know, this election, the Maduro's party, the United Party for Socialism in Venezuela, has taken the majority of the National Assembly. What are your thoughts about that, and how do you think that's going to impact the future of Venezuela?
Look, the important thing is, firstly, that the Western countries, Northern Atlantic countries, are going to try to delegitimize this election. They're going to cast aspersions against it. People need to basically tell their governments to cool it. And this hybrid war needs to end. It's going to be important because this assembly will sit on the 5th of January, 2 weeks before the U.S. president is inaugurated. Those 2 weeks are crucial, and I very much hope the assembly will put forward a project and plan for its 5 years of government. And when Mr. Biden comes to office, already Nicolas Maduro congratulated him on a few days after the election in the United States, asked for a dialogue. Biden, to his total, to the shame of the American people, called Maduro a thug, which I think is a racist term, shouldn't be allowed in public discourse. And here's a Democratic presidential aspirant at the time talking in a racist way of another person in the planet. I think whether you like Nicolas Maduro or not, you should condemn the racism of Joe Biden. I think at the time on the 20th, 21st, 22nd of January, probably Nicolas Maduro will make an outreach again to the United States government, because the Venezuelan government has always asked for a proper dialogue. Come and talk to the president. Come and talk to the National Assembly. We have a project. I think if they say that, then let the world put pressure on Washington, D.C. to take the hand offered and sit down and make a grand bargain over this really ridiculous, ridiculous suffocation of the Venezuelan people.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and sharing your information with us.
Thanks. Pleasure. Yeah.
How many socialists we got out there tonight? Come on, let's see a show of left hands. You drive here on a public street, socialist. You go to a public school, socialist. You ever visit a public library? Why? I'll tell you why, because you're a socialist. Like Ulysses S. Grant. Yellowstone National Park. You ever been there? Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Teddy Pinko Roosevelt. That guy was talking about universal health care. You're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating socialist. I remember when my dog got run over by a truck. And the socialist animal control people came and picked up my dog. Then my neighbor's house caught on fire, and the socialist fire department came and put it out. I could have snatched up that dog.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Paul Dobson. Paul is a journalist with Venezuela Analysis, and he's lived and worked in Venezuela for at least the past 15 years. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today, Paul.
It's great to be here, Margaret.
Venezuela just had an election for the National Assembly. Just first, before we begin, can you kind of give me your thoughts on the election that happened yesterday?
Yeah, well, the electoral process seemed very smooth and transparent, as we're kind of used to seeing here in Venezuela. There were no incidents. Everything seemed to work as it was meant to work, which is positive. This was the 26th election in Venezuela since Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999. So it's a fairly well-oiled machine. There was a slight concern this time around because we're using new voting machines for the first time after 95% of the existing voting machines were burned in an arson attack in March. So the vote seemed fine. The major concern yesterday was the turnout, the participation. According to the official figures, the turnout was around 30-31%, which is obviously low, especially for Venezuelan standards. Maybe not that low for the global northern standards, but for Venezuelan standards, that is quite low. And that is worrying and brings up a number of issues, which I'm sure we'll get into later in the program.
Yeah, well, why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, what do you think are some of the factors that played into the lower than expected turnout yesterday?
Well, I think there's a mix of factors. It's very difficult to put your finger on just one or the other. Obviously, there is a certain level of disillusionment across the parties, across the board, with political leaders in Venezuela. A lot of Venezuelans are very clear about, obviously, the problems the country is still facing, the causes of these problems, including the U.S. blockade, the illegal blockade, but also issues like corruption and bad decision-making and brain drain. But beyond the identification of the problems, most Venezuelans now really want solutions. They want things to start being turned around. We're into now a seventh year of continued recession. And so there is, like I said, a great level of disillusionment with all the political party leaders, the left and the right in general. So that's a major factor. But there are other factors which I think we should also mention. For some reason, this time round, the electoral authorities decided to shift quite a few voters from their traditional voting centers and relocate them to new voting centers. This caused a certain level of confusion amongst some voters and would have inevitably impacted on the level of participation to some extent, which we can't obviously measure, but it would have impacted without a doubt. There are other factors as well. For example, we have to take into account the brain drain, the migration out of the country. According to the UN data, we can estimate there are somewhere between 4 and 5 million Venezuelans who have left the country for the last 5 to 6 years. And this essentially equates to nearly 25% of the electoral register, which are obviously people who are registered to vote here in Venezuela for the elections, but aren't actually here in Venezuela physically. So, you know, here we have to build in these sort of factors when we're looking at the levels of participation, the abstention rates. Another factor, of course, is the call from the hard right in Venezuela to abstain from Juan Guaido. Difficult to know exactly how many of the people who decided not to vote did so because he asked them to, or did so because they were maybe busy in a queue for car fuel, or they were out chopping wood because they can't get cooking gas, or maybe they were just relaxing because they've had a really hard week from Monday to Friday. So it's difficult to measure all of these factors, but I think all of these factors certainly had a role to play in this increased level of abstention.
Yeah, well, certainly people are struggling, you know, here in Venezuela. The U.S. hybrid warfare on Venezuela is definitely taking its toll. In this election, as part of the negotiations with the right-wing opposition, the government agreed to choose a new electoral council, which is people should understand that in Venezuela, there's an independent government institution, the National Electoral Council, that runs the election. So this is a whole new council. Do you think that played a factor into how, you know, into some of the rough spots in how the election went?
Very possibly, because the five rectors which make up the new electoral authorities, previously they were, let's say, heavily weighted in favor of government supporters. Now it is a lot more even. It is slightly weighted again in favor of government supporters, but only slightly. But it seems to have had little impact in animating and spurring the opposition to come out and vote. So I think distrust in the electoral system is not necessarily one of the major factors which would have influenced the level of participation yesterday. I think some of the other issues we've already talked about probably played a bigger role.
Okay. Now, what I really want to get into with you is kind of the political environment in Venezuela. You know, as our listeners know, there's been a long-term project now for at least 2 decades to build the Bolivarian Revolution, to, you know, create a socialist country. And, you know, there have been some real roadblocks to that because of this hybrid war that the U.S. is waging. Is, you know, that certainly plays a role in this. You've mentioned some other roles. But at this moment, there's been some changes kind of in the political formations on the left. Can you talk about, you know, how that's come about and why?
Yes, well, essentially, there's a fairly widespread current now in the grassroots of the Venezuelan revolutionary ranks, which are converging on a very similar analysis when it comes to the government policy and the government's proposed solutions to a lot of the problems which the country is facing. It's a reality that we have a criminal blockade against the country. It's the reality that we're in the 7th year of recession. And at this point, we can really see with evidence, with hard evidence and increasing frequency, that the government is looking to resolve some of these contradictions which it's facing in the construction of a project of national liberation in the face of imperialist threats. It's looking to resolve some of these contradictions in favor of large capital instead of the working classes. And this is something which for the poorer people in Venezuela is causing great concern. One piece of evidence, for example, would be the recent anti-blockade law, which was passed by the government without great consultation, which essentially is a law which opens up great parts of the economy and the nationalized public sector economy to privatization. It also rolls back or gives the government permits to roll back a lot of labor laws and labor conditions, which have been hard-fought victories from the Venezuelan working class over the last 20 years in the interests of supposed strategic national interests. So these are the sort of issues which a lot of Venezuelans are now looking at and saying, you know, this government's talking about socialism, it's talking about Chavez, it's talking about Chavismo, but at the same time, it's privatizing. At the same time, it's not really addressing our $1 a month wages. It's not really addressing the increasing dollarization of the country. And of course, when you add in other factors like corruption and a whole range of lack of internal party democracy within the ruling party and things like this, it really is causing a great level of discontent. So the accumulation of all of these factors has basically led a group on the left to some extent draw a line and say, you know, while these policies continue, we can't really continue supporting the state. This isn't what the construction of socialism is about. We continue to be anti-imperialist. Of course we are. The government is anti-imperialist. But when it comes to domestic policy, we have to draw the line because these are neoliberal policies. These are austerity policies. And this has caused these groupings on the left to basically, to some extent, break, especially electorally, with the ruling party, the PSUV, and form a new bloc, which is called the Popular Revolutionary Alternative. It's made up at the moment of 13 different political forces, parties, trade unions, communard movements, campesina movements, a whole range of groupings, LGBT movements as well, who have come together under these common banners that we're looking to basically find a revolutionary way out of the crisis we're in at the moment, not a capitalist way out. And we think that it should be the richer classes, the bourgeoisie, which pays a price for this crisis of capitalism, not necessarily the poorer working classes in Venezuela. And this led to basically an independent set of candidates in yesterday's election, which were on the ticket of the Communist Party, the PCV, and proposed an alternative to the Venezuelan working classes and the revolutionary sectors, an alternative to the policies which the government is presenting to them in the name of so-called socialism.
Yeah, and so can you talk a little bit about the results of the elections in terms of now the new makeup of the new National Assembly and how this new coalition, the Popular Revolutionary Alternative, you know, how that's going to be maneuvering inside this new National Assembly?
Sure. Well, the PSUV, the ruling party, had a great result for them last night. They won around 68% of the vote, which, given the nature of Venezuela's electoral system, equates into a above weight percentage or representation in terms of deputies in the National Assembly. It's more than likely they'll have over 200 of the 277 deputies. At this point, there's still some which haven't been declared, so it's hard to speak with any sort of certainty, but it's looking very likely that they will have well over 75% of the deputies in the National Assembly. The opposition as well have also won their sections of the National Assembly. They won about 28% of the vote across the country and will probably get something like 30 to 40 or 50 deputies, depending on how that vote is distributed. Okay. Also, this is worth pointing out, just a side note on this. This is a massive decrease for the opposition. The opposition in the last National Assembly elections in 2015 won 2/3 of the deputies and nearly 6 million votes. They've seen their vote tally drop by about 75% over the last 5 years, which is, for them, will cause major questions about what they're doing. The PSUV have also seen their votes drop. They've dropped by about 25% over the last 5 years. About a million people who voted for them 5 years ago in the National Assembly elections decided not to vote for them this time round. So that will, again, cause concern for them. Where are these votes? Where are these people? What happened there? No? In terms of this, the new bloc, the Popular Revolutionary Alternative, they returned about 3% of the vote, which is, at first light, not a very impressive result. But it's worth taking into account and contextualizing slightly here, Margaret, because this is a bloc which has had no funding from any side. It's been deliberately blocked out, censored out of the campaigning. They've not been allowed to participate in the national debates, on the radio, on the TV, anything like that. They're the only bloc which has not been allowed to participate for any reason. And of course, given the state of the country and the fact that it's a bloc which is made up of essentially the poorest people in the country, there's been no access to car fuel, no access to any sort of resources for paper printing, to do your flyers, anything like this. So it's been a very limited campaign essentially for them. So initial reaction is that they're actually quite happy with their 3%. Consider a success that they were able to get nearly 200,000 people to vote against or 200,000 revolutionaries to vote against the government, let's say. But obviously that doesn't equate into many deputies. I think it's more than likely they'll only see one or two deputies in the new National Assembly, which have already committed to supporting government policy when it is concerning revolutionary proposals, revolutionary laws, anti-imperialist laws, but also opposing government policy when the government is proposing laws which increase issues like privatization, dollarization, and which harm the living conditions of the Venezuelan working classes.
And so can you talk a little bit about kind of the APR's platform? What types of things, you know, if the APR had more power in the National Assembly, and I know you're building towards that, this is just the first year, what kinds of policies would you see that could deal with the crises that Venezuela is facing?
One of the major policy proposals which has been pushed forward has to do with wages. Venezuelan minimum wages are now about $1 a month, which is absolutely crazy when a box of eggs costs about $3 or $4. A kilo of meat costs something like $4. It's impossible to live on $1 a month. So the APR block and the organizations which make it up are proposing a mobile scale of salaries, whereby where the basic good basket increases in price, then the wage will also increase in a corresponding amount. That's one element. But there's another very important element in the economic proposals, which has to do with a scientific and planned industrialization of the country. Industrialization and diversification of the economy is something which the government have talked about even back in Chavez's time, but we haven't really seen it materialize in any way, shape, or form. And what we have seen has been very sporadic and unplanned. Most people in Venezuela consider that the government has failed to really address the problems which the international blockade, the criminal blockade, has presented to the country in terms of production and dependence on imports. One example is fuel. Venezuela has a severe and acute shortage of car fuel at the moment, leading many people to have to queue to 3 to 4 days to fill up their cars or their motorbikes. This is something which also affected me personally because I'm a motorbike driver and I have to spend 2 to 3 days a week in the queue just to get 5 or 7 liters for my bike. And it's incredible. Obviously, the causes of this shortage are very clear. Venezuela produces enough crude, extracts enough crude out of the ground to supply its internal market. But this crude needs to be processed. This crude needs to be mixed, let's say, with a certain number of diluents and additives. These diluents and additives were previously produced by Citgo in the United States, a Venezuelan firm based in the United States. When Juan Guaido declared himself interim president in January last year, and Donald Trump initiated the oil embargo at the end of January 2019, the U.S. government seized Citgo and all of its assets and passed it over to Juan Guaido and his team. This essentially means that Venezuela now can't import these additives and diluents which it needs to process the crude. So we're all very clear about the causes of the shortages here, but many are now saying, great, okay, we understand this, but then why hasn't the government built a factory to produce these diluents and additives which are needed and become a bit more self-reliant and self-dependent in the production of car fuel? This hasn't been done. So this is just one example whereby a little bit of planification, a little bit of scientific analysis of the economy would come in help. And I think we can really solve a lot of the bottlenecks in our productive processes by industrializing and investing in secondary level processing plants for a whole range of agricultural and base level goods which we are producing.
Yeah, you know, in your view, does Venezuela actually have the resources internally to be able to do this planned industrialization? I mean, it's what, you know, the country needs to do to get off of a, you know, kind of a mono economy. But I know I understand with the pharmaceutical sector that Venezuela had a thriving pharmaceutical industry, but then wasn't able to import the precursors it needed to keep that industry going. Is it a similar situation with the oil industry, or does Venezuela have the resources to do that?
Well, very often it's just a very simple element of the productive process which is breaking it all down. The area I live in is a high agricultural productive area, and often it's the imported seeds. We have everything else we need here, but the seeds are being imported or the chemicals used are being imported. And obviously that then breaks down when we have the blockade applied against us. The Venezuelan state has plenty of mechanisms it can employ to find the resources it needs to start to build and industrialize these public projects. One example, for example, will be a tax reform. Venezuela actually currently and sadly has one of the most regressive tax systems in Latin America. We have no plus value tax here like you do in most global north countries. And the rich in Venezuela pay very, very low levels of tax. So a more progressive tax policy would also generate a certain amount of resources needed. But also Venezuela has some very important international strategic alliances, which are, we have to admit, we have to see, we have to recognize this, which are the product of many years of a very successful international work by both the Chavez and the Maduro government. And they have credit lines from countries like China and Russia, who will be willing to invest, who have invested in the past. And unfortunately, the government have spoiled a lot of these investments through corruption and through inefficiency. But if these sort of credit lines were used and put to better use, then I think then Venezuela would definitely be able to find the resources it needs to start little by little solving these economic problems, these bottlenecks in the economy, and depending on our reliance on imports.
Can you talk a little bit about the timing of the kind of developing this more left element within the Venezuelan politics? Is, you know, how did the current political climate make it, you know, more strategic to be able to create this left alliance?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously the state of these elections, the nature of these elections really paved the way for this sort of partial break off, we can say. The opposition itself was divided into four blocks, one of which was not participating in yesterday's elections. But obviously that these divisions really safeguarded a number of seats and didn't really open up the threat, a threat we've seen in the past, whereby any sort of division within the Chavista bloc may have actually allowed the right-wing forces back into power. This wasn't really an issue in these elections. Also, the nature of the parliamentary elections and the fact that legislators are really tied to their constituencies means that the issues in the campaigning debates really have to be day-to-day domestic issues, because these are people who are represent us in the National Assembly. These are people who have to address their constituent members. And so the issues like shortages, like wages, like the state of public services in the country are really issues which we thought should be at the top of the debate for campaign and potentially above international issues like the blockade, obviously without negating the impact, the criminal impact of the blockade, which has been described as collective punishment by many. No, this has to be recognized at all moments. But the nature of the parliamentary elections really suggests that it was a good moment to bring up these issues, these flags of struggle, the struggle in the rural sectors, the campesino leaders, many of whom have been assassinated, persecuted, without any sort of justice for their families and any sort of reaction from the state. No? And also the behavior by the state in the last 6 months has become more draconian. We've seen the government only recently bring up once again the possibility of a co-government with the right. We've seen the government wink and give a green light to dollarization in the economy. We saw the anti-blockade law, which I've already mentioned, which is essentially a privatization law for large sectors of the economy. So a lot of the elements in the last 6 months have really increased the government's drift towards neoliberal economic domestic policies and really forced us to draw this line at this point.
So the Venezuela has, you know, fairly frequent elections. You mentioned more than, you know, was it 25 in the last 24
26.
Years? 26.
It was yesterday 26, yeah.
Yeah. So what are the next elections that are coming up and how is the APR planning to participate in those?
Well, Venezuela electoral processes that don't give you much respite. You finish one and you're instantly starting to look towards the next one. According to the Venezuelan constitution, we will be holding elections to elect mayors and governors. Potentially this election may be combined into one super election. It's not clear at this point. The following year, in 2022, there'll be elections to the local councillors, and potentially Maduro has brought up the possibility, or he's welcomed, or he's invited the opposition sectors to, if they want to, try for a recall referendum. If the opposition is going to follow their strategy, this will also be in 2022, because it has to be halfway through the presidential mandate. So the next few years, we have plenty of elections coming up. Obviously, I can't speak for the APR, but it seems my analysis at this point would be that it's very difficult. The government have made it very difficult for the APR, for any sort of reconciliation, let's say, with the forces which make up the APR. From the side of the APR, when this happened, when this rupture happened 3 to 4 months ago, there was a clear and conscious effort not to direct attacks, let's say, against the PSEV leadership per se, but rather to focus on alternative proposals in a comradely fashion, let's say. But some of the behavior by the government forces in the last 2 months has really dirtied this working relationship to some extent. We can point to, for example, a number of APR candidates who were persecuted. We saw a candidate who was sacked from his public sector job for being an APR candidate. We saw another candidate, in fact, in my part of the country, a young female candidate who was illegally arrested or illegally detained, let's say, by security forces twice within 4 days and was, in fact, lucky to come out with her life. We've seen another candidate in Caracas was momentarily detained by the security forces as well. All of this happened within the space of 2 weeks after the candidatures were announced. So this sort of attacks by elements of the state, not the state in its entirety, elements of the state, really make it very difficult for us to sit down and work again with these sectors. We've also seen the way that the state has deliberately excluded us from the means of communication. Very recently, President Maduro himself was on a national television address presenting the ballot card to the country, a very positive initiative by the president, with a massive screen. And for about 80% of the presentation, he quite deliberately used his hand to block the PCV card, the PCV ticket on this ballot paper. And this wasn't coincidence. This was a clear attempt to not allow the country to see that there was a PCV card there, which is a card being used for the APR candidates, this coalition candidates. And so this sort of draconian measure by the president really sours the waters and makes any sort of reconciliation, in my opinion, very difficult after these elections. I would strongly bet on the APR running independent candidates in the elections next year and probably thereafter, as long as the government do not shift their policy lines and start applying revolutionary policies, which is what we all really want to see.
Right. Well, sometimes, I mean, not just sometimes, but I think it helps to have a really clear, strong left pole to kind of guide, right, to guide the government in that direction. So to me, it sounds like that's what the APR is trying to create. And I hope that...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And I hope that, you know, that you have an opportunity because basic things like the minimum wage, tax reform, planned industrialization, this is something that one would hope that would be policies that would be supported. So
a critical voice within any revolutionary process is not a luxury. It's necessary. Something which is necessary. And this is something which Chavez was very clear about when he was alive, is it's necessary to hear constructive criticism from a revolutionary perspective, which is obviously very different from destructive criticism from an imperialist perspective. No, right. But to have your comrades and your allies saying occasionally, hold on, you know, maybe we're a little bit wrong on this. Maybe it shouldn't be done like this. How about we do things this way? And to open up these spaces for debate is a very important element of a revolutionary process. So for the government to shut off these spaces of debate, not just now, but over the last 5 to 6 years with their allies, but at the same time to open up new spaces of debate with the large business sectors and the right-wing parties is disturbing and really shows in what direction they're looking to move things. Yeah. But part of the objectives of the APR is to open up these spaces again, is to provide a reference point for these struggles, these day-to-day struggles on the streets, and hopefully to provide the constructive criticism which might be able to bring about a shift in government policy back towards the construction of socialism.
Yeah, I mean, and we didn't really talk about the whole thing with Juan Guaido, but, you know, now that Juan Guaido is, you know, it's very hard to justify giving any legitimacy. There was never really a way to justify it, but now it makes it even less so. And the opposition, you know, it's clearly not, you know, a threat. Hopefully, this new alliance will be able to kind of open up those spaces a little bit more and, you know, show that it's safe to do that and that these discussions really need to happen. So I really wish the APR luck and hope that, you know, that's something that can be accomplished. Do you have any final thoughts that you want our listeners to know about?
No, I think it's very important for your listeners to keep an eye on what's going on in Venezuela. As always, the message is to not believe everything you read and see, especially in the mainstream media. There's always more contextualization out there. There's always more information out there. And it's very important to listen, to read everything that's going on in Venezuela with an open mind and with a critical perspective as well, to analyze it and to really see what's happening below the political interests which are writing and describing the events going on. No?
Exactly. And that's, you know, why your publication that you're a journalist with, Venezuela Analysis, is a key voice in Venezuela, providing those perspectives and that information. So thank you so much for spending time with me today. And thank you for the work that you do.
No problem at all, Margaret.
That's all for today. You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. Let's go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.